Welcome to Best Picture This, where it's usually Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal, usually.
Usually. But today, we're kicking off a new miniseries, veering off the Oscar path to instead travel abroad to the land of international cinema, where for the next five episodes, we'll explore some blind spots from the BFI's recently released Sight and Sound Top 100 of All Time list. This week, we start with their number one movie of all time, Jean Dielman and A French Address at the end. The director is Chantal Ackerman.
In Belgium, actually. So this is, I'm a little bit confused by that, but I believe it's all in French, but it's set in Belgium. So this movie, Jean Dielman, was one that neither one of us had seen.
Nope.
I had never even heard of it before seeing that.
Me either.
Sight and Sound poll. So it's kind of like embarrassing. Like, I mean, we, the prestigious critics that we are, we thought we should probably, you know, at least know, at least have heard of the movie that everyone else thinks is the best of all time.
I don't think we're alone in that boat,
I don't think
though.
So either. I think you're probably right. This movie was on the list in previous polls. In 2000, for example, by a critics poll in the Village Voice, it was number 19 of the 20th century. So it was rated number 35 in the 2012 Sight and Sound poll. So made a huge jump from 35 in 2012 up to one in 2022.
Yeah.
They do it every 10 years. You can listen, you can hear more about the BFI's Sight and Sound poll in our previous episode where we kind of introduced this, or go on Wikipedia and read about it. It was not rated in the director's list in 2012 in the top 100.
Okay.
Not even in the top 100. And this year, it made the top five in directors. The film was given the distinction as number one of all time, tied for fourth in the director's poll. It's the fourth film to top the critics' poll. That's it in movie history. Bicycle Thieves at the beginning, and the very first one they did. Citizen Kane for a bunch of them in a row. Vertigo last time, and then this time, Jean Dielman. It was made for $120,000. It premiered in 1975 at the Cannes Film Festival. And the running time is a tight 201.
A tight 3 hours and about 20-something minutes.
We have a we have a running list of tight 90s. Mm-hmm. I think we should get a little list of tight 201s.
What do you prefer, a tight 90 or a tight 201?
Well, this is...
I'm partial to the 90
myself. It's interesting. It's interesting. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a 94 and calling the movie mesmerizing.
Mesmerizing.
Coming up in the show, we'll ask some questions, talk trivia, keep it or kick it, compared to all of our other movies that we've done in 1975, and then introduce the next one.
Yeah. So first, I think it's important to point out that this isn't a, quote, old movie, as people generally think of that term.
1975 is fairly old, but it's not...
It's fairly old, but that same year, Jaws came out. Mm. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out. Mm. Dog Day Afternoon, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The Godfather came out 3 years before this. Mm. And Rocky Balboa, not of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, comes out the following year. Yeah. So that's a pretty contemporary set of movies.
Yeah.
So I say all this to sort of emphasize that the style of Jean Dielman is not a product of its time. It's clearly a choice.
I see a lot of similarities with this in Jaws. I don't know.
We'll get into that. We have some time to get into that, I guess. But nowadays, they're calling this, quote, slow cinema. And that's not a derogatory term, per se.
Depends. If you're talking to my wife, it is a derogatory term.
Yeah, some people, I think, would say this negatively. But Ackerman is making choices here. She's choosing to film in mostly or all static camera shots. The camera does not move. A lot of long
the
takes.
Tripod was getting a workout.
Oh, week. Yeah. Yeah, that's why it was so cheap to film. They also filmed this, I think, in like 3 days. No reaction shots, very little dialogue, and most important for a movie that's almost 3.5 hours long, the lack of an explicit conflict. There's conflict here, but it's told through nuance. So I think we need to start with the nuance. Mm-hmm. how did you respond to the movie's very minimalist style? Or as the New Yorker called it, its, quote, revelatory tedium?
Well, it certainly is where your mind is going throughout the movie, because it is so unusual, at least for me. It will, if you haven't seen the movie, which you're in good company, many haven't, and I didn't until just recently, although you can watch it on HBO Max.
You can, yeah.
That's how I watched it.
Mm-hmm. All of the movies that we're going to do in this five-set miniseries are all available on HBO.
So it's time to get that one-month trial if you don't have it.
Oh, yeah.
but, like, you're watching Jean Dielman do basically household chores.
Yes.
And it's not like it just cuts, like, okay, I'm peeling a potato. Most movies would then cut to the potatoes are now all in the bowl, or they're eating dinner. No, this one is, I'm peeling the top 10% with one swipe. Then I'm rotating it slightly, and I'm peeling the second 20%. I'm rotating it slightly. And it just, like, you're literally watching her peel three potatoes for like 3 minutes.
Or eating a sandwich, or making a meatloaf, or cleaning a bathtub, or taking a bath. These things all take about 20 minutes a pop.
Yes. And the thing that is really sort of eye-opening early on is that there is one room that you don't go in. Guy knocks on the door, comes in. Jean Dielman leads him to the back of the room. Apparently, there's a cut in time because we don't, you know, 2 seconds later, they're walking back out. And maybe
it's dark
outside. Mm-hmm. So what you learn early on is that she is a prostitute, or she's turning to prostitution to support herself. So that's kind of this, like, underlying, like, weird sense of dread during the movie as she's then peeling potatoes, walking around, doing errands. So you have that going on, and I think that that is definitely, I mean, without that, I don't know where your mind is going in the movie, but the whole time I'm kind of like, how's that going to get resolved? Is, like, her son going to find out? She has, like, a, I don't know, maybe he's like 18-ish, 16-ish. I don't know. Mm-hmm. He's this son whom she is waiting on hand and foot. She's shining his shoes before he wakes up. He doesn't even know. It's like, I don't know if you've seen those little skits that's like, there's this magic table in my house. If I put my dirty clothes on there, they end up folded in my room. Mm. You know, it's like
moms, you know?
Yeah, I know. Moms are great.
They're great.
So, yeah, like, over and over. So I think that it made me think a lot about how time is being portrayed on the screen.
Yeah.
And, like, the passage of time is the subject of the movie, pretty much.
For sure. Yeah. One way that we differ is you brought up sort of when we first learn about her kind of dual life as a prostitute, that you felt a sense of dread to that. I didn't. I saw it more as how it was kind of just an extra mundane part of her mundane routine, that these two things can coexist right side by side, where she could put a pot of potatoes on the oven, go take care of this John real quick, come back, strain the potatoes. It's like she's gotten in such a routine with this that she comfortable to do both.
She lays a towel down on her bed.
Yeah. You know, yeah. She's got a whole routine down. But what you're saying about time is definitely right. And I think that the slowness, it kind of forces you to focus on very small moments and what they mean. You know, her son, that's one of the good surprises in this movie, is when all of a sudden this guy shows up. And you're thinking, is this just like a young guy who's there to pay for her services? And you realize, oh, no, she's a mother, which you would never have known.
Yeah, it's a surprise when the son shows up.
She's got a couch bed in her living room. Mm-hmm. And when you unfold that thing, that's where he sleeps. But when you fold it up, it's just a couch, and it's like he doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And I like how the movie does give you time to, I don't know, just kind of dig into small things like that. Mm-hmm. Whether or not I needed that much time to dig into them is kind of a different conversation, but I'm trying to focus on the positives.
The fact that this sense of dread, I think, is worth exploring a little bit. That's how I describe it. I think that's how I kind of read about the movie just a little bit before I watched it. And so I was like, okay, so that's kind of the conflict here. But it is surprisingly doesn't seem to be very much of a conflict throughout. You get little hints. Actually, I'm going to read a quote here from Tacita Dean, who's a filmmaker. She wrote this in 1999 in The Guardian. She said, I have a few different quotes that I think are really fascinating here because she loves the movie. She's like, Chantal Ackerman is like one of her, you know, heroes in movie making. So when John Dielman drops her potato peeler on day two, you jump out of your skin. This is how she describes it. Uh-huh. Now, I don't know if I jumped out of my skin, but because we have seen the mundane, you know, she's like super, she's very good at what she's doing.
She's very, very regimented, she's which precise, is a part of her character. And you understand that she is controlling her environment for a reason.
Yes. And, but then she drops this potato peeler and she's got, the potatoes are on too long and she's a little frantic, almost like wandering around, like not sure exactly what to do with the potatoes. And then here's how Tacita Dean describes it. By day three, you can no longer bear the fragile grip she has on her life. When the man in the room takes too long and the potatoes get ruined, which you already alluded to, Tacita Dean goes on, she is panicked, flustered, disturbed, and has to run out of the apartment to get more potatoes.
Yeah.
She puts on her coat over her apron, and the fine choreography of her life is shattered. So this is the, again, the very subtle disruptions that I guess is the this is the central conflict in the story, is when her routine is disrupted. And it's kind of subtle.
Oh, yeah, kind of.
It's very subtle.
Yes. I have in my notes here that you could call, when she overcooks her potatoes, the inciting incident of this whole story.
About an hour and a half in.
It happens about almost 2 hours in.
Yeah.
It's just shy of 2 hours.
I would say that that's more the midpoint dramatic, you know, turning point in the movie. And the inciting incident is when we find out that she also is, you know, prostituting herself.
Huh. Okay.
But you know, we're only talking about 2 hours of film here. You know, there's not a whole lot to argue about.
Only 2 hours. Yep.
So let me go to another quote from Tacita Dean.
Okay.
She has used with total effectiveness cinema's greatest tool, the edit. The result, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, cinema's greatest tool being the edit. This is what a play cannot offer. There's no editing in a play.
Mm-hmm.
Cut from one scene to another, passage of time. You know, how much are we, I mean, in a sense, a play can do that by just like goes black and then it's 10 years later. You can just, you get your audience to believe that. Okay. So the result is that John Dielman has very specific time qualities. We know we're not spending every minute of the day with her in a real time event, yet it feels like we are. You thought this was a 3-day movie, didn't you? But it was only 3 hours, only 3 hours long. It is so finely edited that we can no longer differentiate our real time from her real time. And then she asks, what is fictional time? What is time? I think that that is the ambition of the movie. And I'm like, hats off to it. I like the idea that we're like trying to represent something like that. Like, how do you see the passage of time? Because it does. It feels like you're like going through all the mundane tasks with her. Now the question is, why are we being subjected to that?
But you are going through all the mundane tasks with her. I mean,
not all of them, but a lot of them. Because it's not in real time totally.
Yeah, and what she's saying about editing is almost the lack of editing is kind of the point here.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
If you're seeing this
could you see a John Dielman remake by Baz Luhrmann, for example?
No, I can't. But you know, you're seeing her eat a sandwich from start to finish, and during that amount of time, your time does reflect her time. So there are points at which you're running parallel, and then edits that jump ahead because this can't be a, you know, 48-hour movie or
I actually brought, for the purposes of this podcast, a potato.
Okay.
Here you go, Mike. Here's a knife.
Are you just going to listen to me feeling
it? Yeah, I'd like
it?
To watch you do that.
One thing I want to ask you about...
Just kidding. That was the magic of podcastery.
About the chores.
Yeah.
Is we see her doing chores for most of these movies, usually with her back turned to the camera. And I kind of feel like the most unrealistic thing about it is that she doesn't talk to herself all day long. When you're alone at home,
you got to turn on the radio.
And you're doing chores. Do you talk to yourself?
No, I don't.
You never talk to yourself.
I never do.
Oh my God.
Sometimes I think.
Oh, I talk to myself constantly. I talk to the dogs. They talk back to me. It's great.
What I want to know is, what is the sun doing? I want to see a sequel where we follow the sun around and see all of his shenanigans.
Whew.
The sun is quite ungrateful. He seems to not even realize that she is doing all this stuff for him.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Jean Dielman she's not drawing attention to it either.
No.
It's very expected that she's going to make him dinner.
Yeah.
And he's going to eat it. And then she's going to clean everything up. She's going to shine his shoes.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to fold his PJs.
Yeah.
Put them under the pillow. Fold up the bed when he's gone. I think that part of what's going on here is the fact that she is essentially she's basically a slave.
Okay. And
she's like a servant.
I got to stop you right there, though,
okay.
Because she is his mother. So yeah. She has a choice how she raises the kid. And if she wanted to, she could say, clean up your own plate. I'm not your maid, like my mom did growing up. You know,
this is post Jean Dielman. This is what changed everything.
You think this is what Jean Dielman did? I guarantee you my mother has not seen Jean Dielman.
You need to direct her to it and see what she thinks.
So I don't know. Is she a victim? I'm not sure because she...
Did you think at all during the movie about the expectations of what a woman in Belgium in 1975 was supposed to do? Is she supposed to do all this stuff? Is she like the freak who is doing all this and everyone else is like, can you believe Jean Dielman is making all that food for her son and not even telling him to clean up his plate?
No, I mean, that's there. You know, there is a sort of a woman's, quote, place in society thing going on here. And there's commentary on that front. Mm-hmm. But it is her house. And she doesn't need to be shining his shoes. Who's telling her to do that?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that there's a little bit of like... You got to take responsibility for your own life, Jean Dielman. Come on, get him to do some of these chores.
That's why she was prostituting herself.
I guess so. But here's another thing.
Just kind of, are we supposed to see that as being a sense of dread? And this is sad that that's what she had to do? Or is that just part of her life?
I think that it's, I guess both, but I kind of just interpreted it as a part of her life.
Say both.
Because for so much of the movie, I didn't feel that sense of dread. And for so much of the movie, I didn't feel like she resented her son for not doing these tasks because of the language of the movie. It's so quiet. It avoids dialogue. It avoids any sort of traditional drama or conflict. So because of that, you come to not expect those forms of conflict or resentment or even see them boiling underneath the surface. So when he comes over and they have their whole routine for the first time where they move the table out of the way and they together unfold the bed from the couch and then they set the table and they do this, they do that, you get the sense that they've done this a million times before. Mm-hmm. There are no words exchanged. So I don't know. You kind of are training me how to watch the movie when you show me a scene that's that long where nobody's talking. You're telling me that in the world of this movie, people just don't talk like real people do in real life. So during the dinner scene when they're not having a conversation, I kind of think, well, of course they're not, because this is the world of Jean Dielman where people don't have normal conversations. Did you not? Am I wrong?
No, I see what you're saying. I mean, I think that I kind of felt kind of sad that they seem to be basically lonely living in the same house.
Yeah.
And I think that seems a shame that they don't seem to be much of a relationship. Although I think that what she's doing for him, I kind of got, again, it's all unspoken. I'm probably bringing this all from my own experience, but I felt like because she's a mother, she's doing all these things for him, that these are kind of, signs of her love for her son, a mothering love for her son. And it made me think, okay, so all throughout time, I think that Chantal Ackerman is dealing with what is, quote, a woman's place in the society.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think of, like, this has been a woman's lot for centuries and centuries. You know, this is the center of the woman's life. I think also there is some sort of, I also got a feeling of some sort of dignity to what she was doing. There's it's so mundane, and she seems like, oh man, what does she have to look forward to tomorrow? More peeling potatoes.
Yeah.
More, you know, whatever. But there seems to be, like, if it weren't for her doing this stuff, the house would turn into a dump. It wouldn't be a civilized, you know, society, like, without somebody doing these things. So I thought that there's also some, like, dignity. We don't usually watch someone on the screen peeling four potatoes. Someone has to do it. Do we think about that during, you know, when I sit down to dinner? Sometimes I make dinner. But when I sit down to dinner, you know, when I did as a kid and my mom made it, was I grateful for it? You know, did I even recognize what kind of work went into it? So I thought that that's some of the things that I thought stuck with me after watching this movie that were kind of useful and good.
I hear what you're saying.
And you agree.
But I think...
End of podcast.
But isn't that true for everyone, that if we don't clean the house, it turns into a pigsty?
Yes.
That if we don't cook food, we don't eat food? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I do all the cooking in my house.
Mm-hmm. That's because you're post-Jean Dielman.
Yes, I'm a very postmodern man. Anyone will agree. And I'm not comparing myself to a woman in the 60s. Obviously, worlds apart there. So, you know, trying to project myself onto this movie and the way people lived back then is difficult sometimes. But I don't know. I guess my problem more just has to do with, I felt, instead of feeling like she was trapped by all of these things for the first literally 2 hours of the movie, I felt like, yeah, she's got a handle on her routine. Like she's
because you're a man of routine.
She's able to compartmentalize this part in her life that she probably doesn't love.
Yeah.
You know, these guys come over. They don't really talk either, by the way.
Nope.
She brings them to the back room.
See
you
Thursday.
Get done with that.
See you Thursday.
Yep. Hands her the money. There's never seemingly any threat from these guys.
No.
And then she goes back into doing her cooking and her cleaning, and she seemed to have found some kind of equilibrium, even if it's empty, for the first 2 hours of the movie.
Yeah, I agree. And then what makes her drop the potatoes and all that stuff? What although it's nuanced and everything, why is it that she has this subtle break in that, which leads to the surprise ending, which we should talk about in a little bit, but why did she have this break in her routine?
I don't know.
Purely accidental? She just dropped the potato peeler? Or are we meant to see something into that?
I mean, I think that she's a little frayed. And, you know, when you have a bad day, a small thing kind of sets you off.
Yeah.
And I think that we're seeing small cracks in the foundation here. And if she's able to keep everything perfectly in its place, she's able to live this life and walk on that straight line. But if something falls out of it, things stop making as much sense. And then it's kind of harder to live with the loneliness of this lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Well, her lifestyle, her son is probably out in the world, and he probably is talking to dozens of people during the day. I don't know what his personality is. It doesn't seem tremendously dramatic.
He's doing a lot of reading.
Yeah, probably. But I think that's one thing that we're kind of meant to see, is like, these men who are coming in to pay for her services, and this young man who's coming in and out of the home, they have another world outside of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't really. I mean, she goes and runs errands. But I feel like the sense of order that she has created around all these routines, I think that we're meant to see that. And I wish we had a guest, you know, expert homemaker on the show.
I told you I cook dinner every night.
Yeah.
So I'm basically an expert homemaker.
No. Anyway, you know, that sense of like maintaining order becomes like, without it being as perfect as it needs, as you want it to be, I think it is very easy to be fragile and have it be like, you know, oh no, dinner didn't go like I thought.
Yeah.
And this was my performance, so to speak. This was my show. This was the reason that I did all this stuff during the day, was so that I could deliver on the thing that I am here for, you know? And I think that there's probably a lot of like self-worth, you know, struggles. Like, why am I, what is my purpose here? Just to make dinner for my ungrateful kid, you know? And, but you know, because the mother loves the child, you know, her identity becomes wrapped up in what she's doing.
Yeah, because it's such a balancing act. So if anything is thrown off, then you kind of drop all the plates, right? So did you feel like in that first 2 hour block, it was lagging, and that this payoff kind of redeemed all of that? Or were you, I'm a genuine question. I'm not saying it as kind of a underhanded whatever, but were you kind of wrapped up into the mundanity of the first 2 hours, or did the payoff kind of redeem the first 2 hours for you?
No, I mean, you mean the payoff of her dropping the potato peeler?
And everything that comes after it.
I was, as I was watching it, I was kind of thinking, okay, this is a bold move stylistically. It's number one. I would not be watching it if it were not number one on the Sight and Sound poll, you know? My life didn't seem to be a whole lot worse before I knew that it was number one. I know that we're always like discussing like, okay, why do we care what other critics or the Oscars think? Like, that's one of the things we're exploring throughout. But when 1600 critics are polled, and this happens to be the one that the most people thought was the best, greatest movie of all time, I think that it does make me take a longer look at it. And I'm looking for things to try to appreciate as art. Now, I would not put this anywhere near my top favorites list, but am I looking at what could make it great? I think that's interesting to think
about. Yeah, but you're sidestepping the question though, because I'm asking, were you locked in for a majority of the
movie? It's hard for me to say, because some of those questions that I was just saying were influencing me. I mean,
because you can intellectually dissect anything and write an essay about it and come up with ideas and wrestle with whatever.
Yeah. I thought that because you had this prostitution angle, I thought this is going to lead somewhere. They didn't just put that in and then there's nothing else about it. I thought that ultimately that is sort of what the movie is about, is like someone who is so, basically has no options, or feels that she has no options to support a family. And so she's turned to prostitution. Now, where does it go from here? So it took a long time to continue to develop. And I don't know how I feel honestly about the ending, if it feels like it, the very ending pays off or not.
So should we talk about Chekhov's scissors?
Yes, let's talk about it. before we get there, I want to mentioned this Richard Brody quote, sort of similar to what we talked about, but he called it, I think he's a New Yorker critic. He said, it's a tour de force of cinematic modernism that puts time on screen as it was never seen before. Do you like that? Don't like that? Puts time on the screen as it was never seen before.
I can see it, and I could even understand the placement of this on a significant films list, top whatever of what, you know, any kind of list like that, because of how that approach might have influenced other directors, opened the eyes of critics. I completely understand that. The number one thing feels statement-y to me, in a way that rings kind of false. But before we get into that, we should talk about the ending before we kind of zoom out and kind of talk about its place on the on the top 100.
So describe what happens in the ending.
All right. So she gets a gift or something. She brings it into her room. She is using scissors and she's trying to open up this box. At that time, a guy comes over. So she hides the box, puts the scissors on the dresser. And the second she did, I said, oh boy, here we go.
Something's going to get
cut. It's about to go down. So then this guy comes over, and there is another incredibly nuanced scene of them in bed. So nuanced, in fact, that I have to admit, there were times I was kind of confused what was happening. I was like, is this guy passed out? Is he sleeping? Is there sexual abuse going on?
They're having sex. You can see it in the mirror.
Yeah.
You don't see any nudity in this part.
No.
You see his back.
And
he's not particularly
hardly
attractive.
Moving.
He's hardly moving. She has, all you see is her face. And sometimes she looks like she is a little bored. She's like waiting for him to be done and get out of the way.
Yeah.
Other times she looks like she might be in pain.
Yep.
And in the Wikipedia plot description, which is not particularly long, not a long plot, you know, to the long movie, it says that they have, quote, orgasmic sex, unquote. That was not necessarily my interpretation of when I saw it. I'm not sure who put that into the Wikipedia entry. But that, I think, although we don't usually talk about orgasms on the show, yeah, hide the little ears, I think that's kind of important in the movie to know if that really happened or not. Because if she felt abuse / pain, I can understand what happens next. If she felt, let's suppose that she did reach a climax, right? Mm-hmm. Are we to expect to assume that this was an unusual occurrence for her in these prostitution encounters?
Yeah.
And this is another like departure. In either case, let's say it's pain. Let's say it's she reached a climax somehow. What happens next is you see in the mirror, she grabs the scissors and she stabs the guy in the neck.
Yeah.
And she has there, you know, she goes and sits in front of the, she goes and sits at her dining room table. There's blood on her blouse. And she just like sits there for about 5 minutes. And has kind of different expressions, slightly different, of maybe a slight smile on her face, a slight like feeling of resignation, not a lot of strong emotion at all.
No.
And then it ends.
You know what I thought about though?
Yeah.
If that was the one part of the movie that did that, it would be like Michael Clayton. If the rest of it was this kind of
you just have this 10-minute long scene of her sitting there and not anything else.
Yeah, and then it would really force you to think about how is she interpreting this act in this moment? And you know, that was there, but I have to admit that by that time in the movie, I was kind of ready for it to wrap up. Yeah. But I do think that it is a very interesting choice to make that whole thing ambiguous because
I don't know if it's supposed to be ambiguous or not. It was to me though. I was a little confused.
Yeah. And that's the thing with what I was saying earlier about her son, that there are times in this movie where I was not sure if something was supposed to be ambiguous or if it was just in the language of the movie where everything was so understated that I don't know that I just wasn't picking up on what it was that they were trying to communicate in the scene. I don't know. It's confusing. But the minute that she puts down those scissors, I knew that there was going to be a murder. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't feel out of nowhere to me. And it kind of felt like the movie had to do something end.
That's some of my reaction to it too. Like you can't just end the movie with, you know, 2.5 hours of nothing really happening. And then the last scene of also nothing really happening.
Yeah.
Like it really wouldn't feel like there was an end to the movie. So in a way it seemed like a strange, like cop out to then just have her kill somebody.
Yeah.
When there's very little, you know, indication that anything there, she even has that in her. But I also thought that it confirmed if there was a trajectory of, first of all, there is a lot of talk, not a lot, but there is some talk of, sex in the movie. Like her son is like asking her questions a little bit. They get this letter from her aunt or from her somebody, and it's like, you should really get married. You're very young and attractive. You know, there's no reason why you should be alone or something. And those kind of things are in dialogue with the prostitution that's happening at, you know, off screen.
Yeah.
And then you have that. So if you like did a creative edit of this movie and you kind of just hit on those things and made this into like a 90-minute movie, and say you make go from a tight 201 to a tight 90, uh-huh. It'd be a very, very different movie.
Yeah.
It would emphasize those things. You would lose all of the, you know, she's confronted with a lot of tedium in her life.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you think, so you're saying that's confusing. Do you feel like she had some pleasure in the last scene with this John?
I came away from it thinking the movie wants me to think that there was a rape that occurred.
Okay.
But watching the scene.
But she paid, she accepted his money.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that a rape couldn't have occurred though. Because if it was in the middle, it seems at one point that she's pushing him away.
Yeah. And it seemed like she's clearly uncomfortable in some way.
Yes. And it seems like she's pushing him away, but he doesn't move.
Yeah.
And that's when I wondered, is this guy asleep?
Yeah.
What's going on? And I knew that he couldn't have been asleep, but it's just, that's the way that the scene plays out with him not saying anything, barely moving. It does seem like she's kind of in the throes of pleasure there for a second, but then also, anger. It's a weird mix.
Until I saw that Wikipedia description of it, I thought that it was a negative, partial, possibly like almost abusive situation.
Yeah.
And that she was maybe in pain. And then she was like, I'm done with this. You're dead. that seems to make a little more sense to me from what she did afterward.
Yeah. And in ways that this movie handles these kinds of things, from about the 2 hour and 40 minute mark, that's when I marked it because I felt like there's a tonal shift here.
Yep.
And that's where the loneliness really kicks in. That's when the chores take on this sense of desperate busy work almost. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, you can tell that she's devolving. We get these sort of long shots of her sitting in a chair looking concerned. And the rest of the movie, she's not still ever. She's constantly moving. She's like a shark. You know, she needs to keep moving.
It's like Jaws.
Exactly.
That's what we're talking about with the connection to Jaws.
There you go. Full circle. but in that, I say 2 hours and 40 minutes, that seems really late, but that still leaves about 40 minutes left in this movie for for things to happen.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about in terms of a creative edit, I think that you could do something like that where you kind of set up that.
It would be interesting to see that.
That this is somebody who is very routine oriented in full control. Something happens that kind of tips that scale. We get these last 40 minutes.
I mean, there's a reason that people don't make slow cinema very often. Like this tedium is an interesting effect. But you lose, I mean, the reason that movies are so appealing is because you do have these, like, you know, there's a plot, you know, surprising plot. And there's, you get close-ups where you feel their emotion more than you would in other media. And this movie is consciously getting rid of plot, getting rid of close-ups, getting rid of emotion.
And dialogue. I mean, even if a movie doesn't have close-ups.
Hardly any dialogue.
If it has dialogue that... Mm-hmm. You could sink your teeth into, that alone could be a descriptor of character.
Yeah.
And this movie kind of purposefully strays away from that also.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about slow cinema. I don't have a whole lot of notes on it, but I looked at a list of other examples of slow cinema, and they're almost all foreign. I was just wondering if you think that Americans don't have the... American cinema doesn't have the same appetite for slow cinema as foreign films.
Appetite, probably not. I mean, but I'm sure that they exist. They wouldn't be in the Cineplex, but
these don't
but they're
make,
around.
They're not. None of these slow cinema movies are made thinking that they're going to be blockbusters.
No.
So they're all kind of, I think, passion projects. But one example that was on this list was Wendy and Lucy from 2008.
Yeah, for sure.
Kelly Reichardt directed it. And I don't think I would have ever watched that movie if it hadn't been on the New York Times critics list of best movies of the first 20 years of the century. And I did like it quite a bit. I think that movie certainly had a lot more like emotion to it. There wasn't a whole lot that happened. Michelle Williams gets kind of stranded in the town with her dog, and she, you know, she's homeless. And then, you know, anyway, it's, I think it's a good watch. I thought it was pretty, mm-hmm. pretty impressive. Sofia Coppola, Somewhere in 2010, I have not seen, but yeah. that was under the category of slow cinema. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I didn't see any that were clearly like, this is an American filmmaker film.
Gus Van Sant does a few. I'm thinking of Last Days, that kind of Kurt Cobain sort of movie. Elephant is another
one. I watched Elephant. It's from 03, which is like a sort of reimagining of Columbine, mm-hmm. Where you get these long shots of just like a kid walking down the hallway, going about his really normal day, and then all of a sudden you have, you know, this attack. Interesting. Gus Van Sant, Gus Van Sant said that this movie was an inspiration for him, overtly.
Yeah, that would make sense.
There's a critic, Gary Indiana, who said Ackerman's brilliance is her ability to keep the viewer fascinated by everything normally left out of movies.
Hmm.
Now, the question is, why is all that stuff usually left out of movies? Why don't we have more potato peelings in movies?
I mean, in any movie, especially when you get into the experimental mode, and this is something with David Lynch movies that I've said before, I think that it's sort of the filmmaker's responsibility to at least dangle the carrot out there.
Yeah.
And you could take big, big swings after that, but you need to kind of do the work of hooking me first. Mm-hmm. And then I'm willing to go on that ride with you to wherever weird places we're going to go. And I'll extend my patience as far as I can for certain stretches of time to figure out what it is that you're trying to do.
For at least 200 minutes, you're sold. You're in.
Ackerman goes out of her way almost to make this inaccessible, yeah. I think, for most, I don't even want to say most mainstream viewers, for most viewers.
Period, yeah. Except for 1,600 critics who made this number one. So here's the other thing. What if you had the murder at the very beginning of the movie? And then you say 3 days earlier, and then you start with her doing all this very mundane stuff. You know, maybe you trim off an hour. I think that it would be a pretty interesting, it would be a much different experience. The slow cinema thing, you know, I do believe that there is a sense of dignity in these mundane chores that was accomplished by the slowness of it that is, I think, was worthwhile. Yeah, I have a few trivia points, but do you have any other, what other wise words do you have? Although we need to talk about 2001, A Space Odyssey, and how this is very similar feel in some ways.
Yeah, I think that
slow cinema.
That's on the cusp there for sure. I mean, Kubrick plays on those fringes a lot where he'll go super slow for a long amount of time and then something will happen that kind of jars it out and then he makes you wait a while. Mm-hmm. I think he's doing a bunch of other things, a bunch of very cinematic things, giving us visuals to look at, giving us a lot of other weird surprises and tones to kind of fill in the gaps in between nothing explicitly happening, which makes a big difference, I think. But I don't know, just talking about whether or not this belongs in the conversation, maybe not the number one of all time, but in the conversation of number one of all time, I just have a really hard time with saying that it does, because it veers away from traditional structure and narrative and everything else that we seem to value about movies. Mm-hmm. And I don't.
You don't like breaking rules?
I do like breaking rules, and I don't have a problem with valuing an experimental art film. There are some that I value a lot. But I know enough not to recommend these to a lot of my friends. you know what I mean? Like, there are some movies that you just reserve for yourself and a select group of others. And by putting this on the list as number one,
a select group of others, like our podcast listeners.
Yeah,
I'm going to look up.
I think that tracks.
John Dielman on IMDb. Has gone down in popularity recently. Maybe it went up a little bit because of the poll, and then it went back down.
Yeah, and I think that there are going to be people, too, who are going to see this as number one and watch it in a kind of, okay, prove it to me kind of way.
That's basically what we did.
I don't like to watch anything that way, but I think subconsciously that does seep in. You know, when you see that something is so high in the list, it's impossible to not have high expectations. You know, even if someone says, I don't want to hype it, but you really have to watch this thing, then they've already hyped it, you know? So you're kind of tainted.
Yep.
So I don't know. Call me a populist, I guess, but I just need more drama and more conflict.
You need a little more Cronenberg, a little more Tarantino in your life than Chantal Ackerman.
I really do.
I gotcha. I pinned it.
And I try to kind of watch every movie the way that it's intended, the way that it was intended to be seen, and the thought behind it when it was made. But for this one, I could not get on board. Couldn't do it.
Chantal Ackerman is the voice of a neighbor in the hallway.
Oh, amazing, that's her, right? Huh? Okay, that's with the baby.
Yeah, I guess so. She got the government grant from Belgium for $120,000. She described it in one way, made it something different, but apparently Belgium didn't complain and try to get the money back. Probably, you know, it's probably good for the national, you know, GDP of Belgium for the movie.
Yeah.
Who knows?
50 years later, I'm sure it's paying off.
Chantal Ackerman called this movie interview, a love film for my mother. It gives recognition to that kind of woman. I'm guessing more to the tedium of the housewife, more so than to the prostitute or the murderer.
But the quiet dignity that you're talking
about. Yes, that's what I'm. That's kind of one thing I got at. The framing was meant to respect her space, her and her gestures within it. There is a sort of almost, you know, you can say I'm overstating this, but there is a sort of like, there's certainly a choreography to what she's doing. She's doing, it's routine, but, you know, seen in one way, it's like she's, you know, the drawer's coming out, she's getting the shoes, getting the polish, she's putting in this drawer, she's pushing in the chair. All these things are routine, are sort of like, almost like this little, like the ballet of the housekeeping that is.
Well, you get the sense that she's done this a million times. Yeah. She knows the routine. She knows where everything is. It's the first thing that she does when she gets up. She gets the newspaper from down here.
And she does it with almost without thinking, but she never forgets anything except when these little things happen. I think that's what is sort of like this, the crisis, you know. I have forgotten. I have dropped this. You know, I don't drop the peeler, but now I did. And I don't know if it's like she came to a breaking point. That's what I think is sort of missing from the movie, to accept that that's really part of the narrative, that those things, because you don't really know, like, has she been doing this, the prostitution thing for 20 years, for 20 days? Is this the third day that she's doing it? You know, probably not, because the guy's like, yeah, I'll see you next Thursday. Like, there's a routine that's been going on.
Yeah, here. I think it's been a while.
But like coming to the breaking point, I think we're meant to see some sympathy for what she's doing. Met with mixed critical reception. Some critics said it was boring.
Strange.
Some people said it was a meaningless exercise in minimalism. I mean, what are these critics thinking? So it sounds like you would kick it. You would not keep it over Jaws. You would keep Jaws over this.
You know what it reminds me of? When the BFI, putting this as number one, I mean, when I used to do the top fives for the newspaper, like top five burgers in town, and I would throw McDonald's on there.
I remember a key moment when a local restaurant was very upset that McDonald's was given a spot over them.
I would throw McDonald's on there, partly because the McDouble was only a dollar then.
Mostly to provoke.
And that's a great deal.
To get people angry.
But also to provoke, because it gets a reaction.
Why would a critic put this as one of their top 10 movies of all time just to provoke?
I think there's
nonsense.
There's one-upmanship going on. There is advocacy going on. It's go back to the desert island.
You're talking about collusion. It's like the only way this would be up there would be if everyone's like, we got to give this feminist movie its due. Are you in for Jean Dielman?
Maybe they're like, it's enough of Hitchcock and Orson Welles. Let's diversity is king. All these kinds of things. I don't think that it's any conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. I just think that it rings false. If you talk to each one of these critics and say you have one movie that you can bring to the desert island, just one, do you really buy that they're bringing Jean Dielman?
Well, compared to the desert island, this might be exciting. Because you're out there like Tom Hanks, you know, you're desperate for a Wilson out there.
Mm-mm.
I think it'll be very interesting, you know, when we're still going to be doing this in 10 years, right?
Oh, there's no doubt about
2032, be here for episode 1492. That's 1492, the year Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Be here for episode 1492 when we reveal the BFI 100, as if you didn't already see it on, you know, online.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll
mm-hmm.
see if Jean Dielman is still number one in 10 years.
I will make a prediction. It will not be.
I also predict it will not be.
Yeah.
It's going to be nope.
nope.
In our next episode, we're going to talk about Tokyo Story. It's a 1953 Japanese drama directed by Yoshihiro Ozu about an aging couple who go to Tokyo to visit their grown children. If that's not a recipe for a great drama, I don't know what is.
I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen
it. I have never seen it.
So this is going to be my
first
foray.
This was voted the greatest film of all time in the 2012 Sight and Sound. For the directors.
Oh, okay.
For directors only, this was the number one film.
All right, good.
That's pretty interesting. Like, I'm genuinely looking forward to this. It was number four by critics in 2022, and it was also number four by directors.
All right.
Tied with Jean Dielman.
Tied. Until then, find us on social media or wherever you listen. And for all the golden takes, head over to letterboxd.com/Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thank you to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, a podcast that is so finely edited we can no longer understand the meaning of time. Chicken!